University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Robert S. McNamara discussing A Life in Public Service, recorded in May 1996. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation on International Affairs. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert McNamara, who is a Regents Lecturer at the University of California this semester. Mr. McNamara is a 1937 graduate of the university. He served as president of the Ford Motor Company, Secretary of Defense, and president of the World Bank. His most recent book is In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, which has just been issued as a paperback with a new appendix, which include review of the book, both favorable and unfavorable. Mr. McNamara, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you, Professor Kreisler. I'm delighted to be here.
Has a lot changed on the campus since
you
were here?
Oh, yes, indeed. You shouldn't get me started on reminiscing about those days, but it's physically, it's, of course, totally different in terms of buildings. Numbers of students, I'm sure, are up 150%. So the physical change is great. And one of the things that is most noticeable, and to me very heartening, is the percentage of minority students. I guess they're not even a minority now. I understand the percentage of Asian undergraduates is on the order of 45%. Okay. There's wide representation of both Hispanics and blacks. That is totally different from the time when I was here. And I think it's a great step forward.
What impact did Cal have on your career and your ways of
thinking? Again, you shouldn't get me started. Let me tell you a little bit about what I was when I came here, and then you'll understand, perhaps. Neither my mother nor father had ever graduated from college. My father hadn't gone beyond the eighth grade. They were determined that I would go to college. I took the entrance exams for Stanford. At that time, this was 1932-33, very, very few first-class universities in the country required entrance exams. Stanford did. I passed. But it didn't take me long to figure out that I couldn't possibly, even working part-time and receiving scholarships, I couldn't possibly pay the board and room and tuition at Stanford. So I came to Cal. That's the only reason I was here. It's the only first-class university in the country that I could afford to go to. What did I pay? Well, I lived at home. I paid $52 tuition per year. And for that, I had the finest education in the world, and I'm eternally grateful.
And you remain an enthusiastic supporter of the notion of a public sector.
Oh, absolutely. You just can't imagine what this university has contributed, not just to me, but to the hundreds of thousands of others who have passed through, and to the state of California. I believe that the state of California has been the premier state, which there's no argument over, really, for the last 50 years. I believe it's been the premier state primarily because of its education system, particularly the university, but also the primary and secondary education system. I think it's on the verge of losing that.
You majored in economics here?
Yes. Well, I majored in economics with minors in philosophy and mathematics. I really didn't know what I was going to do when I graduated.
And then you went on to Harvard.
And then I went on to Harvard Graduate School of Business. You have to understand a little bit the nature of the times. I was here from 1933 to 37. 25% of the adult males of this society were unemployed at that time. It was economic chaos. We had the two great maritime strikes of the West Coast while I was here in 1934 and 36. I went to sea as a member of the Sailors Union of the Pacific during the summer vacations in 1935 and 1937. The maritime strikes were among the most brutal this country has ever faced. Why did it occur? In part because of this terrible pressure of unemployment on jobs. And the result is that there were so many applicants for jobs that the companies took advantage of it. They were allowing the bosuns on the ships to sell the jobs. So you couldn't get a job as a sailor unless you paid the bosun off. After they won the strike, one of the most brutal in all of history, there were machine guns on the roofs of the wharves on the Embarcaderos. I saw strikers knocked down a person they thought was a scab on Market Street, put his knee on the curb and his ankle on the street and break the bone. It was that kind of a thing. After they won the first strike in 1934, the wages, when I went out, were $20 a month. I rode on the freshman crew. I lost 15 pounds. I had 20 bed bug bites between the knee and the ankle one time. My point is simply that these were extraordinarily difficult times, economic times, and that colored so much of what was going on in our society. And yet, President Robert Gordon Sproul and Munroe Deutsch depended on a rural-dominated legislature, very conservative legislature, for the funds, permitted total freedom of speech and expression in this university. It was a wonderful environment. And I learned the meaning of freedom and the meaning of intellectual opportunity. And I was confronted with the need to understand the conflict at times between obligations and rights. It was a superb education.
Well, is it fair to say then that Berkeley turned you into an Enlightenment rationalist?
Well,
that happen later?
I'm sure some people would be willing to classify me that today, but if you think so, I think it's a function of Berkeley. And I hope I am, let me just say that. I hope I am an Enlightened rationalist. And to the degree I am, it came from this university. Surely I went to Harvard, and I've in a sense been educated in all the years after I graduated from formal education. But my basic philosophy, my basic moral standards, my basic ethical values came out of this university, and I'll be eternally grateful.
When one looks at your career, one finds many Robert McNamara's at any one time, a visionary on the one hand, and on the other hand, an organization man, a manager of large organizations. When I say a visionary, I'm thinking here of the speeches you gave at Ford before you left, calling for small cars, safe cars, and
safety, functionalism, environmental standards, etc. And some people have said to me, and by the way, while I was at Ford, Marg, my wife, and I didn't live in the suburbs that were populated.
You lived in Ann Arbor.
We lived in Ann Arbor, a university community. Uh-huh. We didn't live in Grosse Pointe or Bloomfield Hills, where mm-hmm. the majority of the executives lives, sort of the Greenwich of Detroit, or maybe you'd call it the Piedmont of Detroit. We didn't live there because we wanted our children to be brought up in an academic atmosphere. And I did push for small cars, and I did push for safety, and I did push for environmentalism and functionalism. And people have often said to me, well, you sound like a wild hair. How is it that you were permitted? Oh, by the way, there was
Berkeley? That was because you went to Berkeley?
Well, no, I was about to say another illustration of this this lack of adherence to normal standards. There was a Republican fundraiser, an executive of the company that solicited all the executives for funds, and the basic argument was, look, there's a Republican president, your bonus is dependent upon a Republican administration, and the economy is good because of that, and the company made money, and you get a bonus and therefore contribute to the Republican Party. Now, without arguing the merits of the Republicans and Democrats, I will simply say that I didn't. Mm-hmm. And some people have said to me, my God, how is it you were able to stay there? You lived in Ann Arbor, a university community, you pushed safety, and you didn't contribute to the Republican. How did you handle it? Well, in a sense, Henry Ford and I, and more generally, Henry Ford II, who was the chief executive officer, one of the major owners, and more generally the board and the owners, and I had a deal. I could make profits for them, mm-hmm. And as long as I could benefit the company, they would allow me to pursue some of these idiosyncrasies.
So the next logical question, educated at Berkeley, a visionary at Ford, and some would even say later, because after all it was you who commissioned the Pentagon papers in the midst of the...
And who initiated the poverty-focused program in the World Bank to eliminate absolute poverty in the world.
So may I ask why you didn't become an academic?
I guess I never really felt qualified. Certainly I wasn't qualified educationally. I had intended... to, as a matter of fact, I was a very young, I think I was at the time the youngest assistant professor at Harvard. I was an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Business. There are those in the college who would not consider that an academic. but in any event, I was on the faculty of the Graduate School of Business Administration, and at the beginning of the war, I was on that faculty. I began as a young instructor in August 1940, was there when the war started, and I was working on a PhD at the time. Although I was an assistant professor, mm-hmm. I was working on a PhD, and I had every intention of pursuing that. I left the faculty to enter the Army, and had every intention of coming back. Because my wife and I both had infantile paralysis at the time of EJ Day, her case was very serious, and I couldn't pay the hospital
bills. So you actually
needed
the money.
I needed the money, that's right. I finally concluded, much to my regret, that I couldn't go back. Had it not been for that, I would have been at least formally an academic. I say formally because certainly later in life, my intellectual interests have ranged far beyond business administration, and I'm not sure I would have been qualified to have been a scholar in a discipline other than business administration. Although I think, looking back on my life, I would like to have been.
You know, people in philosophy and political science departments spend a lot of time thinking about the role of contemplation versus the role of action. Clearly, you are a person, although you never took a formal academic position, have sort of understood these tensions and ambivalences. And I said, I sense in your career that these two selves were talking to each other in dialogue.
That's right. And at times I think there is a tension between what you call contemplation and action. But I think there is less tension than most people believe. And I myself believe a person of action, or let's say an administrator, if you will, should put more weight on contemplation, what you call contemplation, should put more weight on establishing values in his mind, establishing goals and objectives for himself, for his organization, those he's associated with. And let me phrase it very simplistically. I don't believe there's a contradiction between a soft heart and a hard head. And in a sense, I don't believe there's a contradiction between contemplation and action. Action should be founded on contemplation. And those of us who act don't put enough time or don't give enough emphasis to contemplation.
Is there a problem in the sense that the logic of action leads down paths that you might not have originally contemplated, though?
Oh, yes. But when I said those of us who have focused more on action than contemplation should put more weight on contemplation, I'm thinking particularly of contemplation that establishes objectives and particularly establishes values. Mm-hmm. If you look at the auto industry, just as an illustration, we had tremendous controversy over safety. And it was an attitude in the auto industry that it should not be concerned about safety. If one talks about safety, this will scare people away. It'll be hard for you and your audience to believe this, but this is exactly the attitude that existed in part of the 1950s. If you talk safety to the public and say we're going to do certain things to automobiles, put in seat belts or padded instrument panels, or design the car so the doors won't spring open, and so on, and you will reduce the injuries in the event of an accident. You'll scare people away from using automobiles. And therefore, the auto industry was in a very real sense officially mm-hmm. opposed to emphasis on safety, either in design or in marketing. I pushed that in the mid-1950s, but there was tremendous opposition. And curiously enough, when the rest of the industry saw we were doing it, they came along, GM and Chrysler as well as Ford. But Ford introduced safety in its 1956 models, which were introduced and marketed in September 1955. GM and Chrysler had somewhat the same characteristics at the same time. We pushed it in marketing. It turned out that the 1956 Ford, for reasons totally unrelated to safety, did not sell as well as the 1956 Chevrolet. Mm-hmm. The Automotive News, the trade paper, in the spring of 1956 said derisively, McNamara sells safety, Chevrolet sells cars. Now, my simple point is that this was, in a sense, a reflection of lack of contemplation, if you want to call it. What is the objective of, responsibility of, the auto industry? It should be to produce safer cars, cheaper cars, more functional cars, more environmentally sustainable cars.
So what's then the key to shaking up an organization so it moves down these new directions?
Well, I think to try to first ensure in your own mind that you understand that there's no contradiction between what I call a soft heart and a hard head, or there's no contradiction between what I'll call social values on the one hand and a firm's financial strength and sustainability on the other. That's really what I was first trying to prove to myself and then trying to prove to others. When I left Ford Motor Company, when I left as president of the company, I was planning and had started preparations toward introducing a small car into this country. I had introduced earlier the Falcon, which was a move toward a smaller car, but I was planning to introduce a small car in this country. It would have been the first small car made by any one of the big three companies. And after I left, that model program was canceled. Now, there were reasons for cancellation, but I think the cancellation failed to recognize that there was, I'll call it a social value, to a car of lesser weight. You didn't have to have a car of 4,000 pounds to take a single person, say a housewife, to the market to shop or have her drive her children to school. You could have a car of 3,000 pounds, and that would save 1,000 pounds of scarce material and labor. It would save fuel as well. Today, let me take the illustration of today. What are the petroleum executives of this country contemplating today in relation to their industry when they oppose action that will move our country toward increasing the fuel efficiency of our automotive vehicles? I just read the other day that gasoline consumption in this country has risen, I think they said 25% per year from 1980 to today. And that is disgraceful. In the first place, our fuel consumption per capita, automotive fuel consumption per capita, is roughly twice that of, say, Germany. And this is a problem. It's an environmental problem. We're putting more greenhouse gas emissions in the upper atmosphere. That's going to lead to climate change. It's a financial problem. It costs us far more. It's a security problem. This fuel comes out of the Middle East, and we're more dependent on a very volatile region. And we're not, in a sense, we're not buying anything for it. We're not buying greater comfort, more convenience, greater mobility. We could achieve the comfort, the convenience, the safety, the mobility with much greater fuel efficiency. The automobile industry today, I think responsibly, some of the companies reluctantly, but I think Ford particularly enthusiastically, would move toward that. The petroleum companies are not. There are some exceptions. I think Shell, I was a director of Royal Dutch Petroleum, I think they would be willing to support it, but otherwise not. Now, I come back to contemplation. I think it is the responsibility of a leader, an action-oriented individual in our society, whether public sector leader or private sector leader, in a sense, to contemplate as well as to act, and to think what his role in society is. And I want to submit to you that the role in society of a petroleum executive today, in addition to making profits for his company, ought to be to help society increase efficiency in the use of petroleum. Well, and I don't think they think of themselves that way. They should.
Definitely leaders in private organizations don't. And sometimes one can even wonder about our political leaders, which leads me to a question. Why did you never run for public office as a man who combines this contemplation?
Well, let me say that in 1964, before the election of 64, when Johnson was running against Goldwater, Lyndon Johnson asked me if I would accept nomination as his vice president. And I said no. Mm-hmm. I said no. I'll tell you in a moment why I said no. Mm-hmm. But I also should hasten to add that knowing Lyndon Johnson as well as I did, I don't want to say that had I said yes, mm-hmm. he would have accepted. He might well have come along a week or two later and said, Bob, I'm so grateful to you for accepting my invitation to serve as vice president, but I just couldn't ask Margaret, mm-hmm. My wife, or your children to accept that mm-hmm. Sacrifice. I know what it would mean to your family. So as happy as I am you accepted, you shouldn't do it. But I didn't say yes. I said no. Now, why did I say no? Not because I didn't put great value on public service. As a matter of fact, I think if I had my life to live over again, I would seek to develop capability to run for elected office. I think it is one of the highest forms of service to our society. At the time, I was wise enough to know I didn't have that ability. Mm-hmm. I'd never run for anything. You shouldn't start your elected career running for the vice presidency. So I was very wise, I think, in turning it down. But, as I say, if I had it my life to live over again, I would try to develop a capability to succeed in elective office.
And is the virtue of politics that there's a feedback mechanism that you have your ears to the ground, in essence, hear what
I think that's a requirement for a successful politician. The virtue of politics, to me, is that you're serving your country and you're serving your people. And I think that's one of the highest forms of human activity.
Right. Let's talk a little about your operating philosophy. You were always and remain a liberal, enthusiastic about the role of government.
Well, I hope so. And as a matter of fact, in the election, what would it have been? It would have been, Reagan's second term election. The word liberal was so despised that finally Cy Vance and I and some others paid for an ad in the New York Times saying we were proud to be liberals. And we thought our society should understand what liberalism meant. And the denigration of it was irrational, unreasonable, and ultimately a disservice to the society. I believed it then, I believe it today.
And why do you think that philosophy has come into such disrepute? I guess really the high point was when the Kennedy administration came in.
That's right. And the high point was the inaugural address of President Kennedy when he used those famous words, ask not what your society can do for you, ask what you can do for your society. That
for your country.
For your country.
Right.
Yeah, for your society, your country. That's what citizenship meant to me then. It's what it means for me today. But that is not widely accepted today. Why not? Because people have totally lost confidence in their government and those who serve it. Now, why have they lost confidence in their government? Several events have contributed to it. Certainly Vietnam and the tragedy of that and the controversy of it contributed to it. Surely Watergate and Nixon's career contributed to it. I think, unfortunately, the loss of respect for government and those who serve it has been contributed to by many of our recent political leaders, including Democrats. President Carter, when he was running, severely criticized bureaucracy. President Reagan did. President Bush has. I think that's unwarranted. I don't mean to say that government servants are all perfect, no misunderstanding. But what I do mean to say is that the senior public servants that I served with and the senior public servants that I have observed, including the senior public servants of today, both Republicans and Democrats, are at least as competent, at least as dedicated as their private sector counterparts. And they're paid far, far less. I was in a meeting a month ago and addressing this theme, and I saw sitting in front of me, the front row of the audience, a federal judge whom I didn't know well, but I knew he was very competent. And I said, you people in this audience don't agree with me on this. I said, I want to tell you something. Here is sitting in front of me a federal judge. He has dedicated his life to serving you. He has a lifetime tenure as a judge. He's working 12 and 14 hours a day for you, and he's being paid less than 10% of what he could learn in private legal practice. We should admire that, and he's not unique. Others in the government are doing the same.
So will the pendulum swing back to what you're saying?
I hope it will. I'm very pleased you're asking the questions, and somebody hopefully will listen to the answers, and I hope they'll be moved by it.
Another
I'm here, as you said, as a regents professor, and I'm associated in part with the School of Public Policy, and they sent me a document to read on the plane as I came out a few days ago. And I just want to read two or three sentences Dean Smolensky wrote, because it deals with this exact point. He said, "I'm tired of the cynical denigration of government. Of course government can do better, but it does good now. That's exactly the point. Surely government can do better. It's not perfect. But I simply want to tell you, if you want to talk about competence, if you want to talk about dedication, it does at least as well as the private sector. And both can do better, and both should do better."
When you came into the Kennedy administration from Ford, I think you were perceived as a manager of large organizations par excellence. And looking back at your career in 67, you said, "Management is the gate through which social and economic and political change, indeed change in every direction, is diffused through society." And you also said in 62, "Running the Department of Defense is not different from running Ford Motor Company or the Catholic Church, for that matter. Once you get to a certain scale, it's all the same."
Well, that was a simplification. There's much truth in it. But if you want to say running the Defense Department, which at times carries a responsibility for putting the youth of this country at the risk of death, if you want to say that's not different from running Ford, of course it's different from Ford. But if you go beyond that and say running the Defense Department, including times when you put the youth of this country at risk, requires many of the same skills, attitudes, philosophical values, approaches, as does managing Ford or the Catholic Church, yes, there are very great similarities between the two. And if you doubt that, you should read the books on the Vatican Council that were written of Pope John. I'm not a Catholic, but I read them with tremendous interest because Pope John created a revolution in the Catholic Church. And there are two volumes written anonymously describing how he brought about the revolution. And it is exactly the approach, the organizational approach, if you will, that a person should take in bringing out a revolution, bring along a revolution in government or in business.
And what is the key ingredient?
The first point is to have an objective. And Pope John had an objective for the Catholic Church. Have an objective for Ford Motor Company. Have an objective for government. By the way, on that point, I might take a second. In the book you mentioned, I comment on some of my conversations with Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. And one page I say, I went in to see President Kennedy one day. I just loved him, admired him. And I said, "Mr. President, I have a view of the office of the presidency and the way in which it should be handled, and I'd like to express it to you and have your comment." And he said, "Sure." And I said, "Look, I'll graph it for you." I said, "On the vertical axis is power, and on the horizontal axis is time. And you come into office at 0 years, you got 8 years ahead of you, hopefully, and you have a certain amount of power at that time. I hope when you leave, you'll go out with zero power. And I hope you will have expended the power in the interest of achieving the objectives that you feel our society should be moving toward." Now that, and he said, by the way, he said, "Bob, that's exactly the way I look at it." Now the point of the story in relation to your question is, you have to have an objective. What are you there for as president? And if you don't have an objective, you can't expend your power to achieve the objective. The president's job is to help lead the country, not as a dictator, but as a persuader. Lead a democracy. To lead a democracy, you need the concept of values and objectives, and you need them to put your concepts at risk in the forum of public debate, and have them debated and hopefully move the people to support them and move the society to that. Kennedy thought that way.
In the liberal administrations that you were in, both Kennedy and Johnson, so there were two big goals then, following what you said. One was the continuation of the New Deal reforms, which ultimately became the Great Society, but the other was exercising in a responsible way American power in the world.
Well, there were three goals. One was civil rights. That's somewhat different than the New Deal and the Great Society. Okay. One was civil rights, and I think both Kennedy had it and Johnson had it, and Johnson, a Southerner, a Texan, moved to put through the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act, and people didn't think he would do that. They didn't think he would turn his back, if you will.
They thought he would turn his back.
They didn't think he would turn his back on the South,
right.
Which in a sense he did.
Yeah.
And he opposed the Southerners, Dick Russell from Georgia and many others who opposed the Civil Rights Bill and who opposed the Voting Rights Bill. And Johnson led the fight on the Civil Rights Bill in part because, in a sense, he had inherited that bill, if you will, from President Kennedy, and he thought he owed it to the president, and he didn't want to be criticized for not pursuing the civil rights idea that Kennedy had had. But also, he fought for it because he believed it. And when the Voting Rights Act came up, it was his bill, and it certainly wasn't inherited from Kennedy, and he fought tooth and nail to get it through. And I observed and participated in discussions he had on both of those bills, and he fought. So that was one tremendous achievement.
And the number two?
The number two was, I'll call it, following what you said, the Rooseveltian philosophy of the role of government, particularly dealing with poverty. Mm-hmm. And the Great Society was focused on dealing with poor, the Job Corps and the Head Start program and so on. And we've turned our back on a lot of that. And today, in this society, I think it's a disgrace. In the richest country in the world, the percentage of children below the poverty line has risen by a third in the last decade or so. And today, we have 20% of our children below the poverty line. That is twice the level of Germany or Canada, who are less wealthy than we. I think that's a disgrace. Now, Johnson was determined to, in a sense, avoid that. So his Great Society was that. And then both Kennedy and Johnson pursued what I will call a responsible role for the U.S. in international affairs. We've turned our back on that. Look what we're doing in the United Nations today. We have failed to pay our general assessments to the U.N. We are the country that owes more to the United Nations in unpaid dues than any other. We've failed to pay our assessments for general administration. We've failed to pay our peacekeeping assessments. We've failed to fulfill our obligations to the multilateral financial institutions, the World Bank, for example. We have cut our official development assistance program of foreign aid to the other countries of the world, which, by the way, amounts today to something on the order of 0.15% of GDP. It's less than half of that of the other OECD nations, the lowest of any industrial nation in the world. In all of these respects, we're failing to carry out our responsibilities to the world.
It was this third goal, though, in the time that you were in office where things went awry. And what I'm curious about, and I know you've written this very impressive book, and it's hard in a brief interview, but in a nutshell, what went wrong with our goals, and why couldn't we adjust them as things began to unravel?
Well, I think what went wrong was a basic misunderstanding of the threat to our security, or a misevaluation of the threat to our security represented by the North Vietnamese pressure on South Vietnam. It led President Eisenhower in 1954 to say that if Vietnam were lost, or if Laos and Vietnam were lost, the dominoes would fall. That was a famous expression, the dominoes will fall. It wasn't just President Eisenhower believed it. I'll call it the establishment in the U.S., and it didn't matter whether you were Republican or Democrat. If you'd been associated with foreign relations and responsibilities in the post-war period in dealing with the Soviet threat to the security of the West, and it was a very real threat, there's no question of that. I think we all in the 50s and 60s may have exaggerated it, but there's no question it was a threat. During the 7 years I was secretary, on three occasions we came very, very close to war with the Soviet Union. They put pressure on West Berlin to take West Berlin from NATO in August of 61. We came close to war then. They introduced nuclear weapons into Cuba. We came close to nuclear war with the Soviets then, and that was in October 62. They were backing Egypt to destroy Israel, eliminate it from the face of the earth. In June of 67, the hotline was used for the first time in connection with that. The message from Kosygin, the Prime Minister of the Soviet Union, to Johnson was, if you want war, you'll get it. So we faced this, what we considered, a terrible threat to Western security from the Soviet communists, the Chinese communists. I think we exaggerated, but to some degree it was real. But with respect to Southeast Asia, I am certain we exaggerated the threat. I doubt that had we never intervened, I now doubt that the dominoes would have fallen. I doubt that all of Asia would have fallen under communist control. I doubt that the security of the West would have been materially and adversely affected had we not intervened, or had we withdrawn after it became clear that we were having serious problems militarily. That was our major error. Now, why did it occur? Well, it occurred for many reasons, but one of them was we didn't know our opposition. We didn't understand the Chinese. We didn't understand the Vietnamese, particularly the North Vietnamese. So the first lesson is know your opponents. And I want to submit to you, we haven't learned the lesson. We don't know our opponents today or our potential opponents today. We don't understand the Chinese today. Look the way we've been behaving. I don't know who's more stupid today, the Chinese, the Taiwanese, or ourselves. But, you know, there were live warheads being shot into the Formosa Straits within the past week or two. There was a threat of Chinese military action against Taiwan. There was action in the Congress that gave every reason to believe that if there were Chinese military action against Taiwan, we would go to war with China. Over what? For what reason? With what benefit? To whom? With what cost? We don't understand China today. Bosnia. Do we understand the Serbs, the Croats, and the Muslims today? I doubt it. I don't think so. Do we understand the Muslim fundamentalists today? I don't think it. I think this country is quite ignorant of many of the facets of the world that we must gain greater knowledge of if we're to act intelligently and responsibly in relation to these other cultures in the world. And to go back to a point I made earlier, you asked what difference I observe in the University of California at Berkeley today versus when I was here. As I said then, one of the greatest differences, 45% of the students are Asian. At least we've made that step forward. And that, I think, is a tremendous step. We're going to understand the Asians better. And by the way, they're going to understand us better as a result of that. And each of us, if we're ignorant of them, let me tell you, they're ignorant of us.
I hear in the course of our discussion you're really sensitive because of your education and the person you are to the need for change in an organization. And in your book, in great detail, you cover the course of the war and you really sort of talk about the way your position was evolving as you conducted the war. And you were, in a way, put in a kind of tragic dilemma. Were you not, in the sense of trying to change the course of the war, but limited by what you felt was a responsibility to the president and the government that you were part
of? Yes, it wasn't so much the responsibility of the president I felt limited to me, but rather the contradiction, or the dilemma, if you want to put it that way, between a belief, and I believed it then, that the dominoes would fall if we lost Vietnam. I say today, I think that was an exaggeration, but I believed it then. It was certainly the conventional wisdom among what I'm going to call the foreign policy establishment elite, no question about that. The leaders of our foreign policy establishment, the Bob Lovitz, the Jack McCloys, the Dean Achesons, and so on, all believed it at the time. I believed it. I think we were wrong, and certainly I misjudged that. But that was one belief I held. The other belief I held, which was not held by many of my associates at the time, was that we couldn't win militarily in Vietnam. And so I had a contradiction, in a sense. If I believed that losing would advance the cause of, I'll call it, communism across the world, both Chinese communism and Soviet communism, and yet I thought we couldn't win, what to do? Mm-hmm. And what I said then was that we should shift emphasis from the what I call the military track toward the political track and seek to engage in negotiations to try to withdraw our forces militarily without seriously weakening the position of the West vis-a-vis Chinese communism and Soviet communism. So that was the course I was pushing and trying to pursue. And I clearly wasn't persuasive enough.
And in the back of the political leader's mind, here I'm talking about Johnson primarily, I mean, to what extent was he worried about A, the Soviet Union as a military threat, B, his fear of the political consequences of losing what appeared to be a domino, and third, how much was he worried about nuclear weapons, that is, that a war that he would win would escalate into one in which weapons would have to be
used? Let me deal with the last point first. The chiefs, on two or three occasions, recommended action in Southeast Asia, which they said might lead to a military confrontation with China and the Soviet Union. In which case, they said, and they were candid and honest, they said it might require the use of nuclear weapons. They, in effect, were wanting to expand our military operations there to possibly involve an invasion by our U.S. ground forces in North Vietnam and or airstrikes against southern China. All this designed to reduce the supplies of men and material from China through North Vietnam into South Vietnam. And they were honest in saying that, that might well lead to an expansion of the war against China and Russia, or Soviet Union, and that that might require the use of military nuclear weapons. Johnson and I were absolutely opposed to that. We were determined not to involve this country in a war with China and the Soviet Union, and certainly not to involve it in a nuclear war. And I must say that General Westmoreland, to his credit, in a meeting, and General Westmoreland was the U.S. commander in Vietnam at the time, to his credit, in a meeting at the University of Texas 2 or 3 years ago when this subject was discussed, said, you know, at the time I thought I was fighting with one hand tied behind my back, but I now realize that what Johnson and McNamara were trying to do was prevent war with China and the Soviet Union, and we did prevent it, and thank God, says Westmoreland. Mm-hmm. Now, this was the dilemma we were facing. So that was one of the points, and we were quite
concerned about the Soviet threat.
Yes, basically. Quite successful in doing that. But Johnson, you say, was Johnson worried by the Soviet threat, and was he worried by the fear of the political consequences of not dealing with it effectively? Well, he was certainly worried by the Soviet threat. He held the views of the McCloys and Achesons and others, Eisenhower, that it's a threat. If we lose in Laos and Vietnam, we'll lose Asia. And if we lose Asia, the Soviets will be strengthened worldwide, particularly against Western Europe and North America. So therefore, that is a threat we must oppose. Secondly, and that was a driving motive. The second point you made, fear of the political consequences. What do you mean by that? What you mean is that in the 60s, long after China had been lost in the 40s and early 50s, there was still a charge that, in effect, Truman or had lost China, or at least the U.S. had lost China. Mm-hmm. Mao had come in and forced Chiang Kai-shek out, and the U.S. failure to support Chiang Kai-shek had lost China, and that was a terrible political charge and a political liability. And what you're implying is that Johnson had that in his mind and didn't wish to be charged with losing Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right on that. But that was not the driving motive. The driving motive was to prevent what he feared would be extension of Soviet and Chinese hegemony across Asia.
You were then presented with a problem. You were you had your doubts. You were constrained. When one reads your book, the general question that arises, not so much the specifics of your particular case, but at what point does a public service, a public servant who becomes disaffected from a policy that he has been a party to, have a responsibility to take a position in the public debate that may be consistent with what his evolving views are?
Let me give you, let me separate into 2 points. At what point does a public servant who has a disagreement with the president have the responsibility to resign? Mm-hmm. I think it's at a point when he feels he can no longer be effective in, mm-hmm. in pursuing his views. In the book, I say, at the end, Johnson and I, two individuals who loved and respected each other, were engaged in intellectual conflict, if you will. I couldn't persuade him. He couldn't persuade me. Something had to give. We parted. Now, to this day, I don't know, and it sounds odd to say it, but I don't know whether I resigned or was fired. But in any event, we separated. And I think at a certain point, that's appropriate. Up to that point, I felt, number one, I knew he wanted me to continue. Number two, I felt I was being effective. I say my last official act was to oppose the addition of 200,000 more troops to Vietnam. I'd been opposing that, opposing the recommendation of General Westmoreland and the chiefs to send 200,000 more troops for several months. I'd been effective. As a matter of fact, I prevented it because after I left, it hadn't been done up to the time I left, and it wasn't done after I left. So I felt I stayed because, number one, the president wanted me to. Number two, I thought I was effective. At the end, we parted because we differed. I think that was appropriate. Now, speaking out, that's a somewhat different issue. And in my case, it was relatively easy to say I shouldn't speak out more than I had. I had spoken out a lot. There was a hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and in August of 1967, I resigned March 1 or February 29 of 68. So a few months before I left, there was this tortured hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee in which, at the end of a long day of my testimony, Senator Thurman, who's still, by the way, in the Senate, 93 years old, said to me, pointed his finger at me, he said, "Mr. Secretary, you are a communist appeaser. What you've told us today is a no-win policy." Now, I said it because I was saying publicly, in effect, in a sense, what I'd said to the president. So the public was aware of that part of my view. Mm-hmm. What the public wasn't aware of, and which I really couldn't discuss when I left, was that we were engaged in very delicate negotiations that I outlined in the book that had been triggered by, oddly enough, by a visit that Henry Kissinger, who was then a professor at Harvard, had made to what was called a Pugwash meeting in Paris. The Pugwash organization just received the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway, in November of last year for its activities, contribution to peace. But in any event, they were meeting in Paris in the summer of 67. Kissinger was there. He was approached by two Frenchmen, Markovitch and Obreck, whom I report on in the book, who said, "If the U.S. has a message to take to Ho Chi Minh, we'll deliver it." Now, to illustrate the degree to which we didn't understand the situation in Vietnam at the time, Ho Chi Minh was probably more of a nationalist, I'll call it more of a Tito, than he was a servant or a follower of Khrushchev. We looked upon him as a vassal of the Soviets. He may well have been more of a Tito, a nationalist. In any event, he had lived in Paris during World War II. He had lived with this man, Obrecht. He was the godfather of Obrecht's child. By the way, Ho Chi Minh, and you can't hardly believe it, had been a pastry cook, if you will, in the Savoy Hotel in London. He lived in this country for a time. There's a real possibility that if we had understood him better, we could have avoided this war. Or after it started, we could have terminated it. And it illustrates my point of how little we knew and understand those people. But to come back to my point, I said to President Johnson and Dean Rusk, I know you think there's nothing in this approach by Markovitch and Obrecht to Kissinger, and you don't want to pursue it, but let me handle it. Something might come up. We've tried these things before. Nothing ever happened. But I will promise not to get us in trouble, and let me handle it. So I engaged in a long series of exchanges with Kissinger, with the full knowledge of the Secretary of State and the President, over a period of months. Our efforts failed, and I suggest why in the book, in part because we were clumsy, in part because maybe there was nothing in it. I don't know. But I know we were clumsy. In any event, our efforts failed. But they were still continuing when I left. And after I left, the President, in March of 1968, made a speech in San Antonio in which he put forward publicly the elements of the proposal that we had put forward, I'll call it secretly, through Kissinger to Ho Chi Minh, which became known as the San Antonio Formula. And that ultimately was the foundation for the start of negotiations between North Vietnam and the U.S. and Paris. Now, that was underway when I left. I couldn't talk publicly about this. Beyond that, if it hadn't been, well, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, in the midst of a war when 500,000 American young people's lives are at risk in the midst of a war in a foreign country, can't speak candidly and freely without some constraint public. So those were the reasons.
So, in other words, you want to separate your particular constraints, but on the other hand, I get the sense in what I've read that you've written and your participation in the nuclear arms, nuclear weapons discussion in the 80s, that you really do believe in public education. You even believed in it as you were Secretary of Defense.
And frankly, one of the reasons I'm here at this university as a visiting professor now, a Regents professor, is that I hope to contribute to the public education. And later this afternoon, I'm going to participate in a panel discussion debating the long-term objectives for nuclear weapons in the world. I think we, the U.S., should lead the world to eliminating nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. I know that's not widely accepted among security experts, but more and more security experts are accepting it. Just as recently as two months ago, the Stimson Center in Washington published a report signed by four retired four-star officers, including General Goodpaster, Eisenhower's military assistant, who was later the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and three other retired four-star U.S. officers recommending elimination of nuclear weapons. Paul Nitz and I also signed it. The Prime Minister of Australia has just appointed a commission to consider the same subject. General Lee Butler, the former commander of the U.S. Strategic Air Command, is a member, as I am. I think the commission is going to recommend elimination. But it's just the beginning, assuming it does. It's the beginning of a public education campaign. I strongly believe in public education, and I think it's the responsibility of public officials while they're in office and after they leave office to contribute to that education. Absolutely.
I hear another purpose emerging out of our conversation, another purpose of your book, which is this a fair interpretation that whatever emotional catharsis, whatever going through the record on Vietnam that was involved. Another thing here, it may have been important for you to write this book to maintain this commitment to public service as a message to future generations about its importance and that errors are made, but nonetheless things are learned from those errors.
The subtitle of the book is The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam. Now, if you don't accept it was a tragedy, then presumably there aren't lessons to be learned that would prevent a similar occurrence in the future. Some people don't think it was a tragedy. Walt Rostow, professor of history at the University of Texas, who was Lyndon Johnson's national security advisor, to this day doesn't believe it was a tragedy. He thinks we fulfilled an important purpose. We achieved our objective. In a sense, we won. And he wrote a long review for the London Literary Supplement, which I have included in the appendix, that says just that. I think he's just totally wrong. And I do believe it was a tragedy, and if it was a tragedy, shouldn't we learn lessons? And if those who contributed to it, participated in it, can draw those lessons, that's their responsibility to do so. That's one of the major purposes of the book. The last chapter focuses on lessons. We haven't learned them yet.
As a regent's lecturer, I guess I can call you professor, and your assignment can be with the paperback edition of your book, which, as you've hinted at, but I should say, includes many of the reviews of the book, so that...
there are 18 of them.
Yeah, some of which are quite critical.
Very
of you.
Very critical.
Critical of you and so on. So I guess my last question would be a question for Professor McNamara, and that is recognizing the times will be very different with different historical forces operating, what lessons should students derive from your life and your career? The lessons of Vietnam, the lessons of your life.
Well, one I think lesson that I've drawn from my life is the value of the necessity of freedom of the debate. And that's what I really want to focus on in that book. If you accept for the minute, and certainly I believe the majority of Americans do accept it was a tragedy, then shouldn't we debate how it came about? I think that's the lesson from my years on this campus. As I suggested earlier, this campus was chaotic when I was here. The society was in a slight exaggeration, not much, on the verge of revolution. 25% of the adult males unemployed. Parents of my classmates were committing suicide because they couldn't provide shelter and food for their families. There was a march of veterans on Washington. Now, this was a chaotic period, and yet, in that chaos, this university fostered freedom of expression, freedom of debate. Out of that came the advances. I don't mean just from this university, but out of that debate in our society came the advances. And we made tremendous advances. And we should be very proud of those advances. While it's true that we have twice the percentage of our children below the poverty line, as do Germany and Canada, it is also true that compared to what existed in the 30s and the 20s, we are taking relatively good care of our elderly today. That came out of the ferment and the debate of the times. We should be very proud of that. And we should go on to responsibly address and debate the best way of solving our other problems today. 40 million people without adequate health care, homeless, crime, drugs, education system deteriorating. These are problems we should debate and develop solutions to through that debate.
Mr. McNamara, thank you very much for sharing this time with you and with us and for being here on the campus. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation on international affairs.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.